Hello, I'm Father Mitch Paquin. Welcome to EWTN Live, where we bring you guests from around the world. This is Holy Week, and many of us in the United States will go back and forth to church to celebrate the liturgies of Holy Thursday, Good Friday, and of course, Holy Saturday and Easter Sunday morning. And we've traditionally done this year after year without thinking too much about what our Catholic faith might cost us in terms of our religious liberty, what effect it might have on our freedom of speech and our freedom of assembly. So since it doesn't really cost us all that much here in the United States, we take it for granted. Our guest tonight is an Austrian-Pakistani author and humanitarian and a convert from Islam to Catholicism. She has dedicated her life to confronting radical Islam and serving those most affected by its violence, Christian slaves, orphans, women and girls who are traumatized and isolated by forced marriage and honor-based violence. Her newest book is called The Price of Love, The Fate of a Woman and a Warning to the West. Please welcome our guest, Sabatina James.
Hello.
Welcome.
Hello.
Good to have you. You yourself were not born in Austria, you were born in Pakistan, correct?
Yes.
And migrated to Austria.
Yes.
Some years ago.
Yes.
But now you live here in the United States?
Yes.
Yeah, good for
it's
you.
It's my exile, basically.
Why would you call it an exile? What's happened?
Exile because I fled from Europe. There are daily reports of rape and murder through the unchecked mass immigration from Muslim immigrants. And in my case, that compounded the death threats that I was already receiving from radical Islamists, both online and on the streets, because I was under police protection. And my story goes back to Pakistan, as you mentioned, where I was born as the granddaughter of a spiritual leader. My grandfather was as thin as he was proud, a man with a long beard and a turban who used to sing the azan from the minaret. And I learned
that. What's the azan?
Azan is the five daily calls to prayer. In the Muslim world, we hear the azan over the minarets. And, you know, I mean, life is very, very different there. You know, in the West, as you mentioned, for many people, religion matters maybe once a week or during the holidays or because of a wedding or a communion in preparation of a first communion. But that's generally because it's largely private and a matter of personal belief. Mm-hmm. But where I come from, religion is omnipresent.
Yes.
Allah exists in every word, and even every hope is prefaced by inshallah, Allah willing. Mm-hmm. And our days were lived in the rhythm of the azan, and all life basically revolved around the faith.
And so people understand what is being chanted from mm-hmm. the minarets is an act of faith.
Yes.
And calling all Muslim believers to an act of faith, which is?
An act of faith, and also the preaching on Fridays against the infidels. Mm-hmm. So many people think that only a few radical people believe in jihad or in killing the infidels. I was very, very little when I heard the preaching against the Jews and Christians. And I didn't need to join ISIS or Al-Qaeda. It was just the Hadith and Quran that was preached from the minarets. And our mosque used to be full. I mean, we had to climb over a mountain of shoes in order to just get inside. And that was our life. It was revolving around Islam and the Islamic perception of honor, which very much depended on the obedience of the women. And when women did not obey their husbands or fathers, I saw the consequences. And those were the screams of women who were beaten, and there were no police to come and help. And they used to cry, cry out aloud so that neighbors would come and help them. So that was very, very normal in the 1990s when I was growing up as a child. It was widespread. It's not just one case. It was just normal. It was just called life.
Yeah, and that really, it would be difficult to change that custom of beating a wife, because it's also something that is allowed in the Quran.
Surah 4, yes.
Yes.
Surah 4, verse 34, I think, yes, that when the wives are disobedient, their husband can beat them. And Pakistan has a lot of honor killings too. I mean, while we're speaking here, some woman has already died of an honor killing, because there are thousands in the Muslim world every year. And there are some scholars who said, well, honor killing is not Islamic. But if the Quran says you can beat your wife, it doesn't define how severe. So you can also beat her to death. That's how the perpetrators argue. And now there, I've had arguments with liberal Muslims who said, well, nah, you can beat her, but lightly. But it's just nonsense, you know? You create a culture of violence by not challenging these sorts of you know, religious beliefs. Mm-hmm. And this has not happened in the Muslim world yet. In fact, whenever you hear a very liberal interpretation of the Quran, it's usually by liberal Muslims in the West who are trying, but whose voices are not heard in the Muslim world.
Yes.
And that's very, very important to understand, that this is not what is preached in the mosques of Saudi Arabia. Because Saudi Arabia will say this is okay because it's the Prophet who allowed it.
Yeah.
Yes.
And see, this is something I think it's worth people understanding. There are two different periods in which the verses of the Quran were delivered by Muhammad.
Yes.
They're the verses that he spoke in Mecca between 610 and 622, before he made the emigration, the hijra, into Medina. And then there are the verses from 622 to 632 when he died.
Yes.
In the early verses, we see the verses of peace.
Yes.
The call to expect God's judgment, take care of the poor.
Yes.
There's no argument in religion.
Yes. This Surah 2, verse 256, right? It's always quoted in all the shows.
That's right. And it's there.
Yeah, it's there.
But then the verses that came, that were spoken in Medina, Yathrib, the other name for the city, those verses become more and more calls. They don't use the word jihad, but they will say, try to kill the infidels. Mm-hmm. You know, katalu al kufar.
Yes.
Or kill them, kataluhum, cut their heads off at the neck. In Surah 8, verse 12.
Yes.
And what's hard for Christians and for non-Muslims to understand, not just Christians, but all the later verses abrogate the earlier verses.
Yes, nasch, it's called, right?
Exactly.
Yes. And, you know, in Surah 98, verse 6, the Quran explicitly says that and compares non-Muslims to the worst of creatures. And it further says that they need to be fought. Christians and Jews need to be fought until they submit and pay the jizya, the tax, for being non-Muslims. And that is, as you mentioned, articulated particularly clearly in Surah 9, which was the last revelation of Muhammad to his followers. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it is very, very important because this is the surah that ISIS and Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations take as their marching orders. So while there are Muslims that do not perform violent jihad and say, well, I'm interpreting this from the Quran, there are validly also those that are interpreting this their way and say, this is how Muhammad preached it. So both are valid. So what's happening, though, is that the liberal Muslims in the West are constantly excommunicating those who are imitating Muhammad. And that is, I think, not fair, because I went to a madrasa and this violence was preached there, and this is what I believed.
Now, by madrasa, what do you mean by madrasa?
Madrasa is a religious seminary, basically.
Okay.
But in my case, it was actually more like a prison. The teacher was always behind a curtain because men and women are not allowed to look each other in the eye. And it's what you do there, basically, is learn the Quran by heart, and they preach the hadith to you. And these are the very places where terrorism is born. Pakistan has around 30,000 of these madrasas. And almost every terrorist you see has gone to one of those madrasas before and has been indoctrinated there. And this is what you learn there. So when people come and say, well, this is not right because my neighbor Ahmed doesn't believe in that, well, maybe your neighbor Ahmed has never read his own scriptures, mm-hmm. and he's mixing Western pluralism with his own interpretation of Islam, but that is not what is preached in the madrasas, not only in Pakistan, but also in Nigeria and all these places where Christians are being killed every single day, because this is what's preached. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's very, very important for even Muslim religious leaders to confront this. Mm-hmm. And just face up to the fact, this is what our faith teaches, just as it teaches the death penalty for people who leave the faith.
Yes.
Apostasy.
Yes. Rida.
Yes. And this is also what I would demand from our bishops in their so-called interreligious dialogues. You know, they're all sitting in their nice tea parties, but they never talk about things that really matter. For example, how can it be that Muslim leaders constantly ask for building more mosques, for more influence of Islam in our society, constantly complaining about Islamophobia, although they have all the freedoms. And meanwhile, in their own countries, they will execute you for converting to Christianity. Now, what would happen if we would turn the tables? If we would say that we will imprison, flog, or execute those in the West who convert to Islam? Mm-hmm. What outrage would we have?
It'd be something that would be impossible.
Yes.
Anybody who tried to harm a person that converted to Islam would be arrested and imprisoned if they were convicted of this.
Yes.
So this is not allowed. But in places, like you say, mentioned Nigeria, there's quite a bit of persecution there and in Pakistan.
And in Pakistan. You know, and thing also about converting is when you grow up in Islamic culture, you learn that Islam is everything. It's not just faith, it's a duty. And it defines your place in the world, not just before God, but also before society and before the law. And when you convert, it's not just a moment of honesty. It's seen as betrayal towards your people, towards your God, and your country. And when you leave Muhammad for Jesus, you are not just changing your mind about your faith, you are stepping beyond what you are allowed to be. And the consequences are so severe because Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, said, whoever leaves Islam kill him. Mm-hmm. And Islamic law makes that clear. Society reinforces that. But what I've seen in my experience with converts is that for most of us, what's more painful than the fear of punishment is actually the loss of the family. Mm-hmm. And it's especially hard for people who have children, for example, because the children are taken from you when you convert to Christianity. It's the children are given to the parent that is still Muslim, gets the custody. Your marriage is automatically divorced. You're divorced. And then many of us, you know, just think, and that's when reality settles in. I'm not just converting. I'm risking everything. You're risking death. You're losing your family. You may lose your children. You lose your inheritance. And your community will reject you, sometimes even persecute you. And then you see everything that you belong to vanish before your eyes. That's conversion in Islam.
Conversion to Christianity.
Yeah, yeah, from in Islam. Yeah, yeah, from Islam, yeah, to Christianity. This is what a lot of people face, especially in countries where you have Sharia, like in Iran. And I've actually have friends in from Iran who sat in prison for converting.
Yes.
Yeah.
In some countries, the civil authorities will execute, yep, a convert.
Yes. You know,
that also has, yes, happened.
Yes.
And in other countries, like Nigeria, mm-hmm, there's a tacit permission, mm-hmm, to persecute the Christians. And by, mm-hmm, persecuting, it's not only the regular burning down of churches,
yes,
but also killing of priests every,
yes,
week,
I know,
killing of even more lay people every, mm-hmm, week. Sometimes when they're in the church, burning it around them, other times kidnapping them. And yet, what's remarkable, you know, Africa, mm-hmm, has now become a Christian majority continent, mm-hmm, after having been Muslim majority.
Yes. Yes.
This, in the countries that allow freedom, mm-hmm, of religion, mm-hmm, there's a lot of conversion to Christianity, isn't there?
Yes. Yes, and I think it has partly to do with the fact that faith in the countries where we come from, Christianity there, is the way Christianity used to be in the times of the apostle, where Christianity was sacrificial.
Mm-hmm.
But Christianity in the West has become a sort of therapy. There, God is there to heal me, meet my needs. He's sort of this vending machine, you know, answer my prayers. And this sort of therapeutic Christianity would not even survive the first winds of persecution.
Yeah, no.
Because it's self-seeking, mm-hmm, and self-serving. So if I can't get anything out of God and I have to suffer for him, that's ridiculous.
Yes.
For a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's, this is...
And that's why we're not growing, because it's not real.
Yeah, this is a point that, you know, especially during this Holy Week,
yeah,
we have to remember, you know, that we have a choice to be like,
yes,
Jesus,
yes,
or to be like the apostles that ran away.
Yes.
You know, that tomorrow night is Holy Thursday, and we'll be considering, you know, and meditating on Jesus in Gethsemane tomorrow,
yes,
night. This is where that decision,
yes,
is very real.
Yes, and in my own life, I experience the loneliness. I mean, I often think about when I'm praying during Holy Week, about the loneliness of Jesus in Garden of Gethsemane. And very often I think that a lot of times he allowed the suffering I was enduring when I left Islam and my family and community threatened me. I was threatened with death. And I was seeking help from the church, and I didn't receive any help. And from friends, they were scared. And I was completely by myself. And this is where very early I learned that seeking Jesus means allowing him to continue his passion within your soul. That for me was from the very beginning, the cross. Because this is his message to you when you leave. Either you give me everything or nothing, not just some gift of yourself, you know, but God wants you. And then you need to have detachment from the people you love, which is the hardest thing, meaning that...
Because you haven't stopped loving them at all.
No. And even though, you know, they forced me to marry my cousin and there were death threats and I was taken under police protection, I have so much love for my family because in Muslim cultures, after Allah, family is the greatest value. And we grow, you know, where we grew up, there were no daycares or nursing homes. People took care of each other. So there's a bond that is unparalleled in Western societies today. Mm-hmm. So when I read the Acts of the Apostles and how close the community was and how deeply connected the families were, that reminds me of what we had in Pakistan. But of course, there was also a lot of violence. Mm-hmm. And that's when you don't obey the rules, then you get heavily persecuted. But we have lost that. I see a lot of loneliness, especially with the elderly. I sometimes volunteer for elderly people who are lonely, who have no one to visit them. And I just find it devastating because in my little village in Pakistan, that would have never happened. If someone was lonely because they never married, the village takes care of them.
Yeah. This brings up something else, too, that is characteristic of Islam and very foreign to us. Mm-hmm. There is no difference between secular and religious life.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Everything is united.
Yes.
You know, so that's one of the reasons that, you know, when Sharia law comes in, mm-hmm. it is because it's all part of
yes.
one reality.
Yes.
And when there is the care of the poor, mm-hmm. that's part of the one reality of Islam. Mm-hmm. But also there is this, you know, need to maintain the purity of Islamic faith.
Yes.
And even if you only know a bit, because, mm-hmm. again, a lot of folks don't understand, but in Islam, you have to pray
yes.
in Arabic.
Yeah.
You have to read mm-hmm. the Quran in Arabic, mm-hmm. even if you don't know what the words mean. That
exactly.
doesn't matter. God knows what they mean.
Yes.
And you say them because this is the word that
yes.
is from God, right?
Yes. And that's why a lot of Muslims who think that Islam is a religion of peace are just very ignorant because they've never read it in translation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
This is the problem. I mean, I did because my Quran had Arabic and then a translation in Urdu, which is the native language in Pakistan. But a lot of Muslims haven't, so they genuinely believe that it's a religion of peace. I even know of people who were Westerners and they converted to Islam because someone told them that Islam is a religion of peace, and then that same person went to jihad to kill the infidels, but he was invited into the religion by Islam is a religion of peace. This is very often how that happens. And I think, you know, my book is called A Warning to the West, and one of the things I want people to understand is the Muslims that are coming, especially into the United States, don't think they're going to be like the Irish and, you know, like the Polish or Italians that came and then, you know, they just integrated into the culture. Islam, especially radical Islam, doesn't integrate. It overtakes societies, and that's its very nature, that it wants to expand and Islamize. Mm-hmm. And we need to wake up to this reality that Islam is the fastest growing religion, not only in the entire world, but also in America. Mm-hmm. And this is what we need to understand. Even the church needs to make the effort to understand what they actually believe. How can you reach out to Muslims if you don't know what they believe? I sent my book to all the bishops of the United States. And the silence is deafening. Mm-hmm. From the, I think, 280, four bishops responded. And this just tells me where the priorities are of our church. Those who suffer for the faith take the back seat. Mm-hmm. Because we are so busy with interreligious tea parties that we can't confront and challenge radical Islam. We lack the courage. We saw what happened when Pope Benedict just cited an ancient emperor, and all of a sudden the whole world was burning, and nuns were killed in places where the papal words had never been seen, you know, that
I remember in Somalia nun was killed, stabbed in the back of the neck.
Yes.
Because of the words of the Pope, and she was doing great charity work with poor Muslim women.
Yes.
But it didn't matter.
But what was telling was the reaction of that really holy Pope, I find, was that he did not defend his message. Instead, he said that he was deeply sorry for hurting Muslim feelings. Yeah. And then he was praying in the Blue Mosque. Mm-hmm. And this is our problem. We just lack the courage, you know. And not only do we lack the courage to challenge Islam, in Europe, where I spent most of my life, we have apostatized. And now we have millions and millions of Muslims that came there because Angela Merkel famously opened the borders. And when there is no faith, Islam will inevitably fill the vacuum.
Yes.
Because the search for meaning is not new, but what is new is our lack of courage to profess our own faith and to tell the truth about our history and tell the truth about Islam. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's something that I think part of the problem is that a lot of Christians don't know how to articulate the difference.
Yeah.
On one hand, it is true. We believe in one God who's the creator mm-hmm. of all and the judge of all. Islam teaches the same, mm-hmm. you know, that they believe in one God who's the creator of all and mm-hmm. the judge of all. But while that is something we can hold in common, these other issues are very different.
Very different. And that was the difference for me. I mean, the first time reading the Bible, and especially the story of Mary Magdalene. Because I saw myself and the women of my country in Mary Magdalene. Mm-hmm. And Jesus, when she was accused of adultery, sets her free. And I started to make these mental comparisons between Muhammad and Jesus. A woman is caught in adultery, and she's brought to Muhammad, stoning for the woman. A woman caught in adultery, and they bring her to Jesus, mercy for the woman. Jesus said, Muhammad said, kill the infidels wherever you find them, in Surah 9, verse 5.
Yes.
Jesus said, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you. Muhammad said, I have been commanded to fight against those who do not believe in Allah and His messenger. Jesus says, blessed are the peacemakers. Muhammad was a warlord who participated in countless wars.
Yes.
And Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world. This list can be continued. And it's a long list.
Yeah.
No two men could be more different. And this is what people do not understand. And, you know, we have the tendency in our church to always say all religions are the same and it's just, you know, a variety. Well, then what's the point of converting? Why should I risk my life?
Well, see, that's right. Yeah, and it's nonsense that it's all the same.
Exactly. Why did Jesus die on the cross? What's the point?
Yeah.
If it's possible without it. And, you know, when I read the Bible as a Muslim and Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and there is no way to the Father except through me. That, for me, was a very clear message. But I tell you, I tried risking my life to go to the Catholic Church because I became so interested. I had experiences with Jesus that were very extraordinary, and no one could explain that to me. And I went to a Catholic priest, and I told him about my experiences. And he said to me, it could be that Muhammad was also a prophet. He did not invite me to be catechized or to be baptized. And I didn't give up. I saw a sister on the street once, and I made her stop. She was on her bike. And I said to her, I believe in the same as you. And I wanted her to be happy. And she was very sweet, but she said to me, we just have to believe firmly in what we believe. And then all religions are a way to God. And she, too, sent me back without inviting me into the faith.
Yeah, and see, this is not at all what the Vatican Council said.
Yeah.
It's not the teaching of the church. But, you know, this is where we have a lot of work to do. We also have to take a break.
Yes.
So we'll be back in a couple of minutes. We want to get some of your questions and your comments. So please stay with us. Welcome back. Just want to remind you to consider joining Father Miguel Marie of the MFEAs on a pilgrimage to Sicily, Assisi, and Rome. That'll be October 10th to 23rd. If you want more information, go to visitationpilgrimages.com or you can call 256-347-1475. And also want to encourage you to take a look. I said something to you earlier. Your writing style is really nice. You know, it's very, very pleasant. It's very engaging. And the book is called The Price of Love, The Fate of a Woman and a Warning to the West by our guest, Sabatina James. It is item number 14963. 14963. You can get this book at EWTNRC.com. And I think you'll enjoy it. Ready for some questions?
Yes.
Let's start off with Thomas in Tennessee. Thomas, what do you want to ask Sabatina?
How are you doing, Father?
Fine, thanks, sir. What's up?
Well, I got a question for Sabatina. It's a very simple but fundamental question. Sabatina, do you believe that the religion of Islam and Christianity can coexist peacefully?
I think if it would depend on the Christians, we would coexist because our God is love.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that authentic Islam can coexist with Christianity. And we don't even need to speculate over that. We have a proof with 1,400 years of history where ancient Christian lands, where the apostles were born, where Christians were first called Christians, are today completely Islamized, and that was through the sword. And where Christianity was dominant for the first 1,000 years, today we have Muslim countries, and they were pushed out, they were killed and eradicated. So I think if it depends on the religion of Islam, no religion besides Islam can exist unless it's in submission to Islam.
In, you know, I know places where there is still a Christian minority.
Yes.
Within a Muslim majority.
Yes.
And sometimes they can get along just fine.
Yes.
But if the radical Islamist mentality comes in, it begins to affect, I mean, like you said, if this is what is preached on a regular basis, that, you know, you have to try to kill the infidels.
Yes.
And that is heard, trouble starts out where there had not been trouble.
And not just the infidels, even liberal Muslims, they will become victims of that too. I mean, Pakistan, for example, they even imprison Muslims for blasphemy. Mm-hmm. And there was an incident where a Catholic woman was imprisoned and given the death penalty in Pakistan. And one secular Muslim stood up for her. He was very liberal. And his own bodyguard murdered him for standing up for that woman in prison. So people are also afraid. So there are elements, of course, even in Pakistan, in Indonesia, and those Muslims do exist, but they don't have the say. And we also need to differentiate between Muslims and Islam. When we are speaking about Islam, we are not speaking about the practice of Muslims, but the teachings of Muhammad. This is all that I'm speaking about today. So if it depends on his teaching, there can be no other religion dominant over Islam. This is why a lot of these scholars always feel that they are oppressed because Islam is not in power yet. And we used to differentiate between Dar al-Islam, where Islam is dominant, and Dar al-Harb.
Yeah, Dar means home of Islam.
Yes.
Dar al-Islam and Dar al-Harb.
Yes.
What does that mean?
House of war. That's where Islam needs to become dominant. So you need to look for ways to make it dominant. And jihad, the violent jihad, is just one way. But what's actually more dangerous is the jihadis wearing suits, speaking perfect English, and sitting in interreligious dialogues in political circles and infiltrating the different political parties. There's actually a study that was done, I think it was in France, where they said, and the study revealed that almost every political party in the in Europe has been infiltrated by the Muslim Brotherhood. And the same is happening here. I mean,
So folks understand, the Muslim Brotherhood is a particular part of Islam.
Yes.
It follows what's called Salafi theology, that every individual can declare a jihad on their own. That's Salafism that started in Egypt. Muslim Brotherhood has different groups.
Rooted in Egypt,
They have
But their tactic is just different than those of the violent jihadis. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was recently, I read about, I think it was two young men in New York who wanted to kill as many Americans as possible, and thankfully they were caught. Mm-hmm. And these young men, they had grown up in the U.S. They have perfectly nice people. They're super neighbors. They serve them tea when they come to visit and live in $2 million homes. And they just wanted to kill Americans just for the sake of performing jihad and go to heaven. And this is the problem with radical Islam, that they're using all sorts of different ways to Islamize the West. It's the internet. I was in Germany, for example, when I heard the message of the Islamic State to how to perform jihad in daily life. And they described how you can just take a knife and just go and kill infidels. And in 2023, we had over 3,000, knife attacks in Germany. Mm-hmm. So many of those are by migrants. And this is what's happening every single day. People don't realize. We have knife attacks in Germany, even in Sweden, in mm-hmm. France, mm-hmm. all over. And this is coming to America. Mm-hmm. And people need to wake up to this reality. I think America today is like Europe was 20 years ago. When I started to warn them, I was the first siren to sound the alarm because I saw this coming and I was very, very young and they wouldn't take it seriously. I was just like, who is this extremely young woman who is telling us that we need to take this seriously and there's an Islamic threat? And they allowed millions of refugees to come. And what was devastating is that Pope Francis and the Catholic Church accommodated that. Mm-hmm. So I really ask myself sometimes, and I don't want to think about that, but are our bishop and our own people in the church working towards the destruction of the Christian West? Or why is it? Mm-hmm. Why are they not responsive? You know, I had the same experience that I have with the bishops in America, I had in Germany. I wrote a letter to all the German bishops, and I asked them one question. Will you meet with persecuted Christians? Not a single one met with the persecuted Christians. There were a few who at least wrote back some nice letters, but none of them was willing. And when I came to America and people told me the American church is doing much, much better, I have to say, I see no evidence of that. If you don't care for those who suffer for the faith, what does it matter if you have more church attendance? It means nothing. Mm-hmm. You have abandoned Christ in his passion. When he's going towards Golgotha, when he is beaten, when he is spat upon in the persecuted, you abandoned him. And you think your 100 rosaries are going to make it up. No, it's not charity. And this is what I don't understand with our bishops here.
Right? And I think one of the sources that can help us better understand here is we have many, many priests who have come to the United States to help in our parishes, mm-hmm. given our shortage of clergy.
Yes.
And they've come from Nigeria.
Yes.
And they know it from inside that culture.
Yes.
Where there is a very large number of Christians being killed.
Yes.
And kidnapped mm-hmm. and sold into slavery.
Yes.
This is permitted in Islam, correct?
It's permitted. I mean, not just that, forced conversion. That's a big thing in Pakistan. Little girls are taken, they're abducted, and then forcefully converted to Islam. Right now, I'm dealing with a 7-year-old who has lost her mother when she was 3 years old, and her father has 5 other children, so there are 6 altogether. And he earned $3 selling vegetables every day. And he put her in a hostel because he couldn't take care of her. And now this 7-year-old girl was raped because sexual violence is something that happens to Christian girls every single day in Pakistan. And very often they take these girls, then they forcefully convert them to Islam, and the parents receive a letter, your child is now a Muslim. And that's the reality. And then they say to the victim, if you go back, I'm going to wipe out your entire family. That I know of girls who have said that. who were rescued and said, this is the way they dealt with me, and they record the sexual violence and say that they are going to use it on the internet, they are going to dishonor them, they're going to dishonor the family. And there is another case right now in Pakistan of this young girl, she's 12, she was abducted, and the man forcefully converted her to Islam, and the parents went to the court, and the court, federal court, just ruled that the Muslim man can rape this girl as much as he wants. She's now a Muslim. So all you have is parents left in devastation with a church that won't care, because who cares? It's in Pakistan, it's not here. Mm-hmm. And also, who wants to challenge Islam? It's easier to challenge other topics. Mm-hmm. You know, because no one kills you for that.
Yeah. This is something that I think, especially again, as we said earlier, in this Holy Week.
Yes.
You know, as we contemplate, you know, Christ's crucifixion, you know, we can hear the words that were said by Jesus to Saul on the way to Damascus. You know, why do you persecute me? Well, in this case, you know, why do we ignore those mm-hmm. who are persecuted? Yeah. This is something that we need to bring to mind yeah. and keep very carefully mm-hmm. that I've talked a lot over the past 20-some years about how the last 100 years has seen the largest number of martyrs mm-hmm. of any period of the history of the
yes.
church. Over half of all yeah. the martyrs of the church
yeah.
were martyred in the last 100 years,
yeah.
and it has not stopped.
It has not stopped, and also what we need to understand is, even though you may not see the martyrs quite yet in the West, you are seeing the same tendencies towards young girls, for example, in the West. In the UK, there were grooming gangs of Pakistani Muslim men who targeted young British girls. And for decades, these girls were raped and were treated as sexual slaves. Police knew, social workers knew, and politicians knew, and nobody did anything. These were children, because everyone was afraid of Islamophobia. And this is the problem even within our church, that they won't confront Islam because Islamophobia is weaponized.
Mm-hmm.
You can't speak freely about Islam, because you will get the accusation of Islamophobia. And so we are betraying the victims, and we are enabling the perpetrators by remaining silent.
In other words, we are phobic
yes.
about Islamophobia.
Yes.
We have a fear
yes.
of the fear of Islam.
Yeah.
And this is not,
yes.
You build fear
yes.
into the way you
yes.
react, then you are only going to react and never take initiative
yes.
to do the things you must.
Yes, and I think it's very important for the coming generation, especially to inherit what everyone else had before them, a Christian West. You know, it's we must ask ourselves, do we want the coming generations to enjoy the same freedoms that we've had? Or do we want to leave behind an Islamized West in combination with atheism?
Mm-hmm.
Is this what we want to leave behind? And if we don't, then besides living our own faith, we need to educate, especially parents, grandparents have a role to play in that, to teach them the importance of understanding what Islam teaches about Christians.
I think to clarify, for people who love freedom, mm-hmm. it's important to understand that the word Islam mm-hmm. means submit.
Yes, submission. Uh-huh.
And a Muslim mm-hmm. means someone who has submitted. Mm-hmm. It's a passive participle
yes.
that you have submitted
yeah.
to Allah yeah. and to the Sharia mm-hmm. and to all the teachings of the Quran. Mm-hmm. That's what it means. Mm-hmm. The notion of freedom mm-hmm. is not a high value.
No, it's not.
It's submission is, in fact, in Islam, everyone is expected to be Abdullah. Mm-hmm. Abdullah means the slave of God.
Yes.
That you are not the freeman of Christ.
Yes.
You don't have the freedom that works itself out in love.
Yes.
But it's rather submission that is the highest value, and becoming a slave of Allah
yes.
is the highest value. This is very different than our Western culture.
Yes.
And only ignorance of Islam and ignorance of our Christianity
yes.
would make us inactive in responding to this.
Yes.
Yeah, this is important. And I think the other part of this is to pay attention to those who are being who are suffering so much.
Yes.
Children who are being forced into sex slavery.
Yes.
Boys and girls.
Yes. And Father, what I wanted to mention was this, is that, of course, we have these sorts of things as well in the West. You know, you just look at happened with Epstein and, the Epstein files. But there's a difference. I don't know a single Christian or a single Jew who thinks that what Epstein did was right. Everyone says it's wrong. Whereas when you have millions of underaged girls sexually violated because they are married when they are 6 or 9 or 10 years old with husbands that are the age of their grandfathers, then this is allowed and accepted within the Muslim community. And that's the difference.
Yeah.
We don't teach that. We see that what Epstein did as a sin. But in Islam, the founder of Islam, Muhammad, his youngest wife was 6 years old.
And it was his favorite.
Yeah.
Aisha. Yeah.
Aisha was his favorite wife, and she was 6 years old when he was about 50. And this is the problem with Islam, the role model of Muhammad.
Yeah. There's a lot more of this to discuss. I would recommend you take a look at The Price of Love, The Fate of a Woman, and A Warning to the West by our guest, Sabatina James. It is item number 14963. You can get it at EWTNRC.com and learn even more about the work that she continues to do and this great stuff. Thank you for coming here to join us. And may the Lord bless all of you and keep you and cause his face to shine upon you. May our Lord lead you in all of your ways by his peace. May Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And I want to conclude this evening by strongly urging you to go to the services and pray the liturgies. Know that you've got the freedom to go where they don't have that. I don't think even this year in Jerusalem they can go to the Holy Sepulchre. So live your freedom in order to worship God and to receive him and to show love of him. Be there tomorrow night on Holy Thursday. Be there on Good Friday for the various services at your parishes, and then on Holy Saturday and Easter Sunday. Don't let that slide, but come to know Jesus and know how much he loves you. God bless you all, and have a wonderful and blessed time of celebration of the death and resurrection of our Lord. Thank you.